news tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN wants Rwandan rebels to disarm. The leader of Mozambique's Renamo Party is arrested. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The United Nations is increasing pressure on Rwandan rebels in eastern Congo to disarm a day after UN and Congolese forces seized bases of a different rebel group. Martin Kobler, chief of the UN mission in Congo, said in a statement today that the seizure of the bases is a strong signal for all armed groups, including the FDLR, that the only way to forward to peace is through voluntary disarmament. Wire services report that the leader of Mozambique's opposition Renamo Party was arrested today. Antonio Muchanda, heard speaking here, was charged with inciting violence and leading an illegal demonstration. Demonstrations were sparked in the country by last week's court affirmation of the victory of Felipe Nyusi and his Frelimo party in recent elections. Renamo has charged voting irregularities. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has changed three major offices in his government following a failed coup attempt last week, according to a report by the Reuters News Service. At the same time, AFP reports Mr. Jammeh is vowing to track down those who plotted last week's attack on the presidential palace.
And nobody can destabilize this country. I swear to the Almighty Allah. So anybody who comes to attack this country, be ready, because you're going to die.
The attack was repelled by the presidential guard today. He lamented that the nation's Supreme Court had allowed previous coup plotters to appeal their death sentences. He vowed that that would not happen again. This is VOA News. Reuters reports two Egyptian policemen were shot and killed today as they guarded a Christian church in the city of Minya. The attack came just ahead of Wednesday's Coptic Christmas celebration. An Interior Ministry official denied that the shooting was an attack based on religion and insisted that it was aimed at security forces. But a number of churches and Christian properties have been destroyed in Egypt the past several years. Reuters quotes a Libyan government official as saying the government has banned Palestinians, Syrians, and Sudanese from entering the country. He charged that people from those countries have been undermining Libya's security. Meanwhile, forces loyal to President Abdullah Al-Thani launched an air attack on the western city of Misrata, an area linked to a rival Islamist parliament. Wire services are reporting that a new drug for Ebola is being tested at a health facility in Monrovia, Liberia's capital. The drug, brincidofovir, has been tested in consenting patients at the Elwa 3 Center operated by Doctors Without Borders. Officials hope to find out if the medication, which is being used to treat people suffering from other viruses, might also help those with Ebola. The new U.S. Congress convenes today in Washington with Republicans controlling both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Opposition Republicans are beginning the new two-year legislative session with their strongest numbers in several years. They swept last November's midterm elections and hold 240 seats in the 435-seat House, the party's biggest majority in 70 years, and a comfortable 55 seats in the 100-seat Senate. An Israeli military court has sentenced a Hamas militant to three life prison terms in connection with the murder of three Israeli teenagers. The court also ordered Hussam Hassan Qassame to pay $63,000 in compensation to each of the three families. The court issued the sentencing today at a hearing near the West Bank city of Ramallah. Turkish authorities say at least two people have been injured in an attack by a female suicide bomber in Istanbul. Reports say the woman entered a police station in the Sultanahmet district and detonated her explosives. Both of the injured are police officers. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Searchers today pulled the bodies of two more Air Asia crash victims from the Java Sea. The remains of 39 of the 162 people aboard Flight 8501 have been recovered after 10 days of searching for wreckage off the coast of Borneo. Briefly looking at markets on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down. European markets also down. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the Gambian government's reaction to a December 30th coup attempt has been swift and, quote, unprecedented, according to human rights groups that say dozens of civilians and security personnel have been detained. The story has taken on an international dimension as well, with arrests in Senegal and the United States.
That's VOA's Anne Luc reporting from Dakar. Details coming up.
Also in the news, thousands of Central African Republic refugees continue to flood into Cameroon despite a shaky peace deal between warring militias.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Gambian government's reaction to a December 30th coup attempt has been swift and unprecedented, according to human rights groups that say dozens of civilians and security personnel have been detained. The story has taken on an international dimension as well, with arrests in Senegal and the U.S. VOA's Anne Luc has more from Dakar.
Security remains tight in the Gambia a week after gunmen tried to overthrow President Yahya Jammeh. Authorities are hunting for those suspected of involvement in the December 30th coup attempt. They monitor and search people at the borders and at checkpoints along the main road to the capital. Several of the alleged coup plotters are believed to have fled the country. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, are warning countries not to extradite suspects to the Gambia. Amnesty Senegal country director Sadi Gassama says it would be a, quote, scandal to extradite someone to the Gambia. Under international law and the UN Convention Against Torture, he says, you cannot extradite someone to a country where there are grounds to believe he will be tortured or could be executed extrajudicially. Rights groups initially reported that Guinea-Bissau had detained several Gambians. Guinea-Bissau said Monday that is not true. Senegal says it is expelling Gambian dissident Cheikh Sidi Abayo, a joint French-Gambian national, though it's unclear on what grounds. Rights groups say they believe Senegal will send him to France. Two American citizens of Gambian descent are being charged in the United States for their alleged roles in the coup attempt. The complaint says they were among 10 to 12 people who entered the Gambia from the United States and Britain to try to overthrow Mr. Jammeh. It's against U.S. law to conspire to take up arms against a country with whom the U.S. is at peace. Gambian President Jammeh came to power in a coup in 1994. His government is criticized abroad for human rights abuses and what Amnesty calls, quote, iron-fisted repression of dissent. Mr. Jammeh condemned the attack on December 30th as a, quote, terrorist act mounted by, quote, dissidents from abroad. Rights groups say there has been a wave of arrests inside the tiny West African country. An activist monitoring the situation from Dakar told VOA he knows of at least 22 relatives of suspected coup participants who had been detained for questioning, as well as several security officials. He said the relatives have included an elderly mother and children under the age of 18. He said some have been released. Anne Luc, VOA News, Dakar.
Thousands of Central African Republic refugees continue to flood into Cameroon despite a shaky peace deal signed between the warring Seleka and anti-Balaka militias. The refugees fleeing the violence are finding relative peace in Cameroon's refugee camps, but are struggling with growing humanitarian needs and hostile host communities. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited them in eastern Cameroon.
Yvette Faradongo has just lost her two-year-old daughter to malnutrition after she managed to save her from the rampant violence in the Central African Republic. Yvette trekked for 3 weeks from the CAR village of Beberati to eastern Cameroon.
On file à mort.
She says she had to run for her life after her son got a bullet in the leg and her sister was killed in confrontations between the Muslim Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka rival groups. Every Central African I met here at the Giwa Yagombo refugee camp in eastern Cameroon has a story of horror, pain and trauma. Francis Dengo lost his wife in the sectarian violence before escaping the Central African Republic. He says he continues to get bad news from his country.
Il y a aussi un cousin. Arrivé ici, j'ai écouté qu'il avait pris aussi une balle.
He says he has just been informed his cousin was shot dead and the rest of his family sought refuge in the Bangui Bimbo St. Mark Major Seminary. But what is more important for him now is his survival in Cameroon. The influx of refugees into Cameroon has dropped from 10,000 a week to about 8,000 people per week, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Some humanitarian agencies, like the Cameroon Red Cross, say the drop is because those suffering from malnutrition cannot make the long and difficult journey to Cameroon. UNHCR field officer Constancia Teribe says her organization, along with other aid agencies, is doing the best it can to treat the exhausted and malnourished refugees.
We are working on this and we are trying to recover all these people because they have been traveling for a long time, maybe weeks, or some of them they have been walking through the forest. So they come exhausted and they come with, some health issues. But this is why health is one of the major assistance that UNHCR and its partners give to the refugees.
Refugee Francis Dengo says even with their disturbing health conditions, the refugees are still exploited by their host communities and harassed by local government officials.
La difficulté majeure que nous rencontrons, c'est la libre circulation, il n'y a pas. La raison, c'est que...
He says they are not free to move out of the camps, even when they are hungry, and Cameroon security forces do not recognize their food rationing card issued by the UNHCR as identification documents. He adds that some of them are asked to pay bribes to remain in Cameroon. He says some people here hire them to work in farms, and once the work is done, they refuse to pay. Constancia Teribe says if Cameroon would recognize the identification documents issued by the UNHCR, it will solve some of the problems.
There's a very young operation, and to issue the refugee card, it takes time because it needs to be agreed with the Cameroon government. So we are working on it, and we hope that we will be in the position to facilitate this document, accreditate that they are refugee and their situation in the country.
But a retired engineer from Bangui, Augustin Dolly Debat, says the refugees will not return home anytime soon because Cameroon for now is the better of two devils.
Question de repartir ou ne pas repartir, c'est lié à beaucoup de facteurs. Vous savez qu'il faudrait d'abord qu'il y ait la paix dans le pays.
He says the question of going back or not will only be addressed when peace returns to his country. If we come to Cameroon, he says, it is because we know that Cameroon is a peaceful country. So if there is no peace, we cannot return. And how will the person who decides to go back home survive after losing everything? The UNHCR estimates there are now more than 200,000 CAR refugees in Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Eastern Cameroon.
The World Health Organization has released new figures for the West Africa Ebola epidemic. It now says there have been more than 20,700 cases and more than 8,200 deaths. In related news, travelers entering the United States from Mali will no longer face enhanced screening for the Ebola virus. That's because the country has been declared free of the virus. Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, is conducting clinical trials of an antiviral drug on Ebola patients in Monrovia. It's called Brincidofovir. Any patients who test positive at the MSF treatment center will have the opportunity to receive the drug. The drug has been used to treat other viruses. The president of the African Union says the fight to control the Ebola virus has united the interest of West African countries. On a tour of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, acting AU chief Mohamed Oub Abdelaziz says the virus has consolidated the governments of the region. The Iraqi Ministry of Health and the World Health Organization say they have found no evidence of the presence of the Ebola virus in the country. Local newspapers had published rumors of a possible Ebola case in Mosul. They determined the rumors were false. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wahib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The coup in Gambia has taken on an international dimension with arrests in Senegal and the United States. Thousands of Central African Republic refugees continue to flood into Cameroon despite a shaky peace deal between warring militias. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The ghost ship trend of smugglers deliberately abandoning hundreds of migrants on large disposable crafts in dangerous waters is becoming a lucrative trend for them. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says they are concerned over the recent increase in abandoned vessels at sea and the lack of disregard for human life on the smugglers' part. With thousands of people now fleeing Syria, the smugglers are able to predict how much revenue each trip will bring and then quickly deploy vessels and crews. IOM reports in the past week more than 1,000 terrified migrants had to be rescued from an abandoned vessel in the Mediterranean Sea. Flavio Di Giacomo is an IOM spokesperson. He spoke with me about the plight of migrants who are left stranded in treacherous waters.
Well, we are a bit concerned about it, of course. We are starting to see these arrivals from Turkey since the month of November, more or less. These are mainly Syrian migrants who arrive on these big cargoes carrying up to 800 migrants sometimes. We are worried because, of course, the trip is very long and is dangerous because the cargo used by the smugglers are very old and unsafe, and also because this trip is very, very expensive because it can cost from $4,000 to $6,000 each. It means that these smugglers are making a lot of money, and so they can even buy other ships, and this new route then could even increase. Apparently, this new route is a consequence of the Syrian war, of course, and the flow of Syrians who flee from the country, especially those who went from Syria to Turkey. There are almost 2 million Syrian refugees in this moment in Turkey. So it is a direct consequence of that.
Also, I understand that you all have been speaking with some of the migrants who were rescued from the abandoned vessels. I'm sure this was quite a terrifying experience for them. What are they saying?
We have been talking with migrants arrived in these weeks from Turkey, even with a family who, for example, arrived from Kobani in Syria, the city under siege of the ISIS. And they told us that there are other Syrians who flee from Kobani, for example, that they went to refugee camp in Turkey, and then that some of them, since the sea crossing was too expensive, decided to go by land to Greece. So there are some refugees who try to reach Europe by boat, and others who apparently try to reach Europe by land going to Greece. This is quite a new situation because we are used to see arrivals from Libya and from Egypt, but mainly from Libya, which is a country in a very very unstable conditions and very dangerous. Now, this new road from Turkey is quite new, so it's very difficult for the moment to understand what can be done, because the first thing to do would be to understand how the smugglers work.
Can you explain how exactly this process works? What are the smugglers actually doing now?
This cargo are taken at high sea. So these refugees are brought from the smugglers from the coast with the small rubber dinghies to these cargoes, which are quite far from the coastal area, about 2 or 3 hours far from the coast. So they are hidden. It's impossible to see it from the coast. So it's a way used by the smugglers to hide themselves from the authorities. But for the moment, we still have to understand how does it work. For example, we know that the official news is that these bandits have been abandoned in a moment where the cargo arrived close to the Italian coastal area. But the Italian authorities were investigating on the arrival of the Blue Sky M, which arrived on the 31st of December, are convinced that actually the driver of the cargo was still on board when they arrived. He just locked on the automatic pylon, and then he pretended to be a migrant and didn't abandon the ship, though. So in this moment, they are interrogating a person. They think that he could be the driver. So it's quite unclear now how this route is working into details. The only thing we know that it's very dangerous, because migrants, they're really obliged to work in very harsh conditions.
So basically, it seems like the primary motivation, again, is just for money. The smugglers abandoning these ships, going out, purchasing another ship, and then taking a different route.
That is the situation. This is the situation. This is a new route, completely different from the route we are used to see. Very expensive route. Smugglers are making a lot of money, and this is the thing that actually worries us more than everything, because it means that with all this money, this route may also increase in the future. We have to be very, very careful about that, and we hope that investigation will come up with the identification of the smugglers who would have to be identified and prosecuted.
That was IOM spokesperson Flavio Di Giacomo, who spoke with me from Rome.
UN troops are preparing for an offensive against FDLR rebels in the eastern DRC. The rebels failed to meet last Friday's deadline to demobilize. A UN spokesman says troops are taking up positions to support the Congolese army's offensive against the rebel group. FDLR fighters include those accused of taking part in the 1994 Rwanda genocide. At the same time, UN and Congolese forces are reported to have seized several bases belonging to the FNL Hutu rebel group. The bases are near the Burundi border in South Kivu province. Meanwhile, the UN is considering scaling down the UN force in the DRC, known as MONUSCO. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for a leaner and more mobile military force. The proposal would reduce the size of the UN mission by 2,000 troops. DRC President Joseph Kabila had wanted a much bigger reduction in the size of MONUSCO. He proposed cutting the 20,000-strong force by half.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. It's been 4 years since DRC authorities issued an arrest warrant for a Mai Mai militia leader accused of crimes against humanity. Nevertheless, he remains at large. Human Rights Watch has released what it says is new information about crimes committed by the militia. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The rights group says the NDC rebels, commanded by Intabo Intibiri Sheka, are accused of killings, mass rape, mutilations, and child abductions. It says the worst of the abuses occurred between August 2012 and November 2013 in and around Pinga, a town bordering the Walikele and Misisi territories. In July of 2011, UN peacekeeping officials tried to arrest Sheka when he sought medical attention in Goma in North Kivu province. However, he escaped. Human Rights Watch says he was possibly tipped off by Congolese army personnel who had a close relationship with him. Human Rights Watch's senior Congo researcher, Ida Sawyer, says NDC attacks continue. She says capturing Sheka remains difficult.
It's partly been difficult because he's operating in a very remote region and it's difficult to find him. But it's also the case that he has shifting alliances and at various times support from Congolese army officers and also support from individuals in Rwanda and alliances with other armed groups operating in eastern Congo. And he's been able to take advantage of this the support that he's gotten in these various alliances to help him evade capture over the years.
Sawyer describes some of the crimes Cheka and his militia are accused of committing.
Cheka's group, the NDC, along with two other armed groups, carried out a brutal mass rape. Nearly 400 civilians were raped between July 30th and August 2nd, 2010, in a series of 13 villages in Walikale territory. Since then, Cheka's troops have continued to carry out a number of vicious killings, and they often have cut off the body parts of those they kill and later parade the legs or heads or other body parts of the victims around town, chanting ethnic slurs.
They're also accused of forcibly recruiting child soldiers and abducting civilians.
They've also abducted a number of women and girls who they are holding as sex slaves, forcing them to be the wives of combatants. And dozens of these young girls, some as young as 12, are still being held by the group as sex slaves in the forest of Walikale.
The list goes on.
In one of the most brutal incidents in recent years, the NDC abducted 30 people, including 20 young school children, from a primary school in Butumuri village in Walikale territory. And they forced these young students to march through the forest for days, and those who were too tired or weak were killed by the NDC fighters.
Human Rights Watch has called on Congolese authorities and the UN mission to step up efforts to arrest Cheka and bring him to justice. It also wants an investigation to learn which groups and individuals are supporting the NDC rebels. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Two Egyptian policemen guarding a Coptic Christian church were shot dead today south of Cairo. AP reports gunmen attacked the police officers in Minya, about 220 kilometers from the capital. Minya is home to Egypt's largest Coptic community, which is preparing to observe Christmas tomorrow, according to the Julian calendar. Also today, another policeman was killed in Giza while attempting to disarm an improvised bomb. No one has claimed responsibility in either attack. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many Ebola patients who are treated in hospital will survive and recover. Ebola is a serious disease, but when people have recovered, the doctors test them, and when the disease is all gone, they are discharged. The discharged patients cannot transmit Ebola. The virus has left their bodies, and they cannot pass Ebola to anyone, not their children, their other family members, people sitting next to them in the taxi or bus. Partners, however, must abstain or always use a condom for sex for 3 months after discharge from the health center. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat.
Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The coup in The Gambia has taken on an international dimension with arrests in Senegal and the United States. And thousands of Central African Republic refugees continue to flood into Cameroon despite a shaky peace deal between warring militias. Coming up, we'll have music from Angola. And in our feature segment, the second installment of our series on palliative care in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi. Bands, we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have more Nations Cup football for us today.
Kim, joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Happy New Year, David.
Yes, thank you, Sunny. And also a happy New Year to all our listeners around the continent of Africa.
David, as we talk, we're now 11 days away to the kickoff of the 30th Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. Let's go group by group. I know you've been compiling tidbits about all 16 teams that will be on the pitches in Equatorial Guinea. We'll go alphabetical order and begin with Group A, Burkina Faso. What's the latest with the Stallions, David?
The Stallions, Sonny, are on their way to my homeland, South Africa, where they're going to play two friendly matches in Nelspruit, which is in the northeast of the country. And that's where they were based in 2013. And I know all our Voice of America listeners have got excellent memories when it comes to football. And they will recall that it was there that Burkina Faso did extremely well. In fact, they went on to reach the final against all odds before losing to Nigeria. What they're going to do, Sonny, they're going to play Swaziland on the 10th. And then on the 13th, they're going to play Botswana. So two warm-up matches. It's an interesting choice, Sunny, South Africa, because the weather conditions here are much cooler than they are in Equatorial Guinea. But the Belgian coach of the Stallions, Paul Putt, he obviously knows what he's doing. He got the rank outsiders to the final of the last tournament. Nevertheless, a slight surprise to me. I thought maybe they would camp somewhere in Central Africa.
Congo Brazzaville. They're next, David.
Yes, Sonny. Congo Brazzaville. Now, the interesting fact with Congo Brazzaville is their coach, Claude Leroy. He has been to the finals seven times, going back 30 years. So if experience on the touchline counts for anything, they could well be one of the dark horses of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. And a quick look, Sonny, at his record. Way back in 1986, his love affair, as he's called it, with Africa began. Cameroon were runners-up. 2 years later, he guided Cameroon to the title in Morocco. In 1990, he was a semifinalist with Senegal. In 1992, he was also with Senegal and was a quarterfinalist. 2006, now he's with the Democratic Republic of Congo, and they reached the quarterfinals. He did even better 2 years later, 2008. He took Ghana, the host nation, to third place. And then finally in 2013, he was with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And for the only time in his tenure in charge of teams, he failed to reach the quarterfinals, the DR Congo side finishing third in their group. So if experience on the bench counts for anything, watch out for Congo Brazzaville.
Next in alphabetical order, David, is the host country. Financially, what is it costing Equatorial Guinea to stage the tournament?
The estimate is about $40 million. And that is one of the main reasons Equatorial Guinea stepped in as last-minute replacements. My understanding, Sonny, is there might, I stress might, have been one or two other countries who would have taken on the task of hosting this competition at the last minute, remembering that because of the Ebola epidemic, Morocco had pulled out. But that figure, that $40 million figure, really put them off. I think Angola were possibly another country that could have footed that sort of a bill. They're like Equatorial Guinea, they're rich in natural gas and oil reserves, although we do know that the price of oil has plummeted of late on the international market. But the Angolans said that they had not budgeted for tournaments such as the Cup of Nations and therefore could not host it. So now we have Equatorial Guinea, a country which is part mainland and part island and has a population of less than 1 million people. They, for the second time in 4 years, are going to host the creme de la creme of African football.
Next up, we have Gabon, which co-hosted the 2012 tournament, David, with Equatorial Guinea. What's the latest with the Gabonese?
The Gabonese have suffered a blow. They've lost midfielder from Marseille by the name of Mario Lamina. He's a young Gabonese-born but French-reared player, highly rated. He was a member of the French team that won the World Youth Championship 2 years ago. And this is one of these classic cases. Sometimes, Sonny, you have a player born in Africa but reared in Europe. And then alternatively, you have a player born in Europe but of African parentage who's wanted by his country of his parents' birth. But Lamina has decided not to heed the call-up. He says he's unavailable. He hopes one day to play for France. And Bonaventure Sakambi has taken his place. So a late change to the Gabonese squad.
Turning to Group B, David, how about the Blue Sharks from Cape Verde?
Interesting thing about the Blue Sharks is the names of their players. For example, you've got Platini. Now, people will say, hold on a minute, Michel Platini retired a long time ago. He's now the president of UEFA. He was, of course, that great French midfielder. Well, actually, the person I'm referring to, he was christened Luis Carlos Almada Suarez. But like so many players from those island archipelago off the west coast of Africa, he prefers a nickname, and he was a great lover of the football of Platini, and he goes by that name. There's also some inventive nicknames among the strikers of the Cape Verde side. For example, there are two Mendes. There's Gary Mendes, who plays for Elche in Spain, and Ryan Mendes, who plays for Lille in France. So, intelligently, one of them chose the first name, that was Gary, and the other chose the surname, which is Mendes. So, when you're watching the final, Sonny, you'll see Gary and Mendes, but they're actually both Mendes now. I hope I've totally confused you by telling you that.
Now we turn to the Democratic Republic of Congo, David. What's the latest with the Congolese?
Well, the interesting thing with the Congolese, again, for those who are going to be watching the finals, and I'm sure that's just about every African on the continent and many outside it, is that it will be the swan song for the great DR Congo goalkeeper, Robert Kidiaba. Now, Robert Kidiaba is the man who invented what they call the bum shuffle. He shuffles around the goal mat on his bottom every time either his club, TP Mazembe, or the national team score a goal. He's got this amazing hairstyle, dreadlocks with a big capital D. And he's also, though, at 39 years of age now, reaching the twilight of his career. And Kidiaba has told reporters in the DR Congo that come what may, Equatorial Guinea will be his international swan song. And I must say, Sonny, when it comes to colorful characters, African football will be much the poorer for his retirement.
Next up, David, we have the 2004 Nations Cup champions, Tunisia.
Unfortunately, injuries are playing havoc with a lot of the teams, and one of them is Tunisia. They've lost one of their midfielders, Ben Hatira. Now, what the Tunisian coach, George Leekens from Belgium, has done, he's named 26 players, and the deadline is January the 7th for the final 23. So with Ben Hatira out, I guess that's made it slightly easier for Leekens because now he's just got to drop two players from the Carthage Eagles. And the Carthage Eagles team, Sonny, that I feel are definitely potential champions in Africa in 2015.
The 2012 champions are next, David, Zambia.
Right, Sonny, and there, a change of captain. For a long time, it's been Stopila Sunzu. He's a huge central defender. He formerly played for TP Mazembe in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but then moved to Sochaux, who are now playing in the French second division, relegated at the end of last season. But he's been moved aside, and in his place, wearing the armband, comes Rainford Kalaba. And guess what? He also plays for TP Mazembe in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, that close Congolese-Zambian connection makes geographical sense because Mazembe are based in Lubumbashi in the very south of DR Congo and is quite close to the Zambian border. And Raincourt Kalaba, unfortunately, not a winning debut at the weekend. Zambia played South Africa in Soweto and lost that match 1-0.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And David will have more Soccerlicious Nations Cup analysis for us later this week, right here on the sunny side of sports. In more Nations Cup news, host Equatorial Guinea has confirmed the Argentine Esteban Becker as their new head coach, replacing the Spaniard Andoni Goico Texia. The 50-year-old Becker had been in charge of Equatorial Guinea's women's team, which he led to the African title in 2012. Coach Becker will not have time on his side. He has 11 days to prepare Equatorial Guinea for the opening match of the Nations Cup on January 17th against Congo Brazzaville. Equatorial Guinea will also play Gabon and Burkina Faso in first-round group play. Turning to tennis, let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out for Serena Williams, the world's top-ranked women's player. Serena won her opening match of 2015 at the Hopman Cup tournament in Perth, Australia. On a sweltering hot day in Perth, Serena rallied for a three-set victory over the Italian Flavia Panetta. The final score, love 6, 6-3, and 6-love. After losing that opening set 6 games to love, Serena said, "I need some kind of energy boost." So she had a cup of coffee while sitting courtside, and the coffee did the trick as she won the next two sets. "I didn't know Serena was a coffee drinker. I love coffee, Serena, and I've got a few blends in mind that I can recommend to you this year in 2015. Serena Williams used that tournament in Perth as a warm-up for the Australian Open, which begins on January 19th in Melbourne. And Serena Williams will be bidding for her 19th, count them, 19th Grand Slam singles title in Melbourne. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and what an amazing athlete.
Expresso.
Listen to the
It's the coffee, though. It's the coffee.
Expresso.
Well, listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the second installment of our series on palliative care in South Africa. And next, we visit a conservancy in Kenya, which is home to 3 rare rhinos pushed to the age of extinction. But first, some music. Here is Angola's Banga with Fukula.
Olha, tu sai do caminho, deixa o estiloso passar. Tem mais banga na passada, tem mais afinco no andar. Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Aí dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Vê como enfrenta os mamos na hora de os encontrar. Pega mais nessa fugula, é muito bom conservar. Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Aí dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Xinga no areal do moceque, desliza no asfalto da cidade. Gongonha de farinha moceque, fez campeões de eternidade. Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Aí dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Aí dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Dá-me fogo,
vai ali.
Enche
sempre um caminho seguro, mesmo quando tudo está escuro. Já não joga na roleta, deixou de ser besta. Aí dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, aí curte meu. Sai do caminho, deixa o estiloso passar. Tem mais banga na passada, tem mais afinco no andar. Aí dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo. Vê como enfrenta os mamos, namorado e os encontrar. Pega mais nessa fucula, é muito bom conservar. Dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo. Xinga no areado, moceque, desliza no asfalto da cidade. Gonguenha de farinha, moceque, fez campeões de eternidade. Eu, dá-me fogo, dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo, dá-me fogo. Engendra um caminho seguro, mesmo quando tudo está escuro. Já não joga na roleta, deixou de ser besta. Dá-me fogo, dá-me fogo, aí dá-me fogo.
Angola's Banga with Fukula.
Well, in South Africa, special nurses wage a constant battle to help people die with dignity. They try to ease the emotional, spiritual, and physical pain of those in the final stages of cancer, heart disorders, and other diseases. They see the trauma as they watch people die of these incurable illnesses. Darren Taylor reports in the second installment of our series on palliative care in South Africa.
Now, at the moment, we're doing the omeprazole one daily, the tramadol for pain.
Rion Fenter's thick fingers crackle across a packet holding used syringes and alcohol swabs. The nurse at West Gauteng Hospice near Johannesburg explains a cancer patient's medication to a doctor. Fenter says some of his patient's organs are failing, so their pain is so bad that they just want to die.
We often see people who are in such excruciating pain that they can't even move, or they move in a very abnormal manner.
But the palliative care specialist explains that with the correct medicines, and especially morphine, physical pain is quite easily managed. It's dying patients' emotional and mental trauma that's hard to handle, says another hospice nurse, Patience Mashetu.
I was a man, I was going to work, I was driving myself, and now a lady has to come in and change me. His dignity is gone, because we come in, we bath him, he can't bath himself. He can dress himself, we dress him. So it's all that loss of independence.
The Diepkloof Hospice in Soweto is near a tangle of dusty alleyways, home to a few hair salons. They advertise services including Dark and Lovely and Easy Waves. Each blasts the owner's favorite tunes. But the chaos and cacophony of the township is barely heard in the hospice's quiet, pristine wards, where floors shine, buffed to brilliance. Patients here have heart and brain disorders, dementia, infectious diseases. Nurse Duduzile Tlapane says she inspires them to kick against death.
I encourage them that life is a war. Try to eat even if there's no appetite. Make sure that you swallow, even if you've got a lot of trash or something. Make sure that something passes through. You must fight, because nothing comes easy in life, because there's no one who's going to fight for them.
But Lapane acknowledges that eventually her patients can fight no longer. That's when she uses another strategy to comfort the people she describes as withering away in front of her.
I like singing. Even when I do the bed bath or what, I sing. So you'll find my patient smiling.
Spontaneously, the nurse bursts into song.
Oh, Pepe Lagulo.
The clicks and cadences of the Xhosa language echo through a hospice passage. Tlapane explains it's a hymn, meaning that whenever you're in a place you think you won't survive, with the Lord, anything is possible.
And singing that song with a meaning, with my expressions, sometimes I even become emotional. Then I quickly run to the toilet because I need not to be emotional in front of the patient. Then I quickly run to the toilet, then I wipe my tears, then I come back, then I carry on with my song.
But the nurse agrees, even the time for singing ends. Fenter says the signs that someone is about to die are obvious.
The skin color will start changing. The skin temperature will start changing. For example, if they say to you, but my wife's feet have suddenly gone a dark color and they're cold.
Fenter has held many people while they die, but it's the children who remain alive in his mind, in his dreams. He says he waits at the bedside for the suffering of the tiny body to end, witnessing the parents' trauma, trying to be a pillar of strength as those around him drown in a sea of pain.
I can sit there for hours and I can silently cry if it's necessary, if I feel that need. I can be extremely strong for people. I'm very honest about my own emotions. I honor my own emotions. I honor the child in me.
Fenter emphasizes that being allowed into another person's space when they're dying is something he never takes for granted.
I see it as an enormous privilege. It's an honorable estate to be allowed to assist with something so profound. And it is something that I can talk about very glibly and very lightly, but it is a very profound thing for me.
Back at Dibkloof Hospice, nurse Rachel Mabena begins her rounds. She says she realizes her job is special, but acknowledges she sometimes drags herself to work. Mabena whispers, "There's so much to think about." I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
More than 1,000 rhinos were killed for their horns last year in South Africa, and the slaughter continues in other parts of Africa. However, a conservancy in Kenya is home to 3 rare rhinos pushed to the edge of extinction by man-made threats. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports on last-ditch efforts to save the species.
Meet Najin, a northern white rhino, one of only 5 left in the world. Get to know her now, the furry fringe around her ears, her squat legs, because within our lifetimes, the northern white rhino could be gone forever. Mohamed Doyo, head keeper in charge of these rhinos at the Old Pajeta Conservancy in Kenya, says conflict has pushed this grouping to the brink of extinction.
This animal, they are originated in Congo, a place called Garamba, northern Congo. They were hiding themselves in a long grass. Not like southern white rhino, you can find them in open place. They like the long grass and hide themselves there. People fight against the tribalism in Congo. Start killing this animal, they couldn't have anything to eat. They use as a food.
The animals here are heavily protected against the ever-present threat of poachers that has decimated all types of rhinos worldwide. The killing is driven by Asian demand due to the mistaken belief that the horns have medicinal properties.
I used to pet them behind the two legs like this and put them down, and they cut that horn today a little bit, tomorrow a little bit. After 1 week, I put that horn down. And we cut that horn purpose of security. Poachers kill our rhino because of the horn.
The population of this particular subspecies is dwindling fast. One of the rhinos here unexpectedly died in October. A zoo in the U.S. city of San Diego lost another in mid-December. But there is still one last northern white hope.
This is Sudan. He is 41 years old, and he is the last male northern white rhino on the planet. His past attempts at mating were unfortunately unsuccessful, so now conservationists are going to try a process of artificial insemination to try to save the species.
The plan is to artificially impregnate a young, fertile female, or to use a southern white as a kind of surrogate mother. If that fails, then they may turn to crossbreeding to widen the gene pool.
You know, it's about preserving those genetic traits which confer upon the northern white as a species or a subspecies, whatever you want to call it, the ability to live in Central Africa with all of the disease and habitat challenges that that presents. Those genetic traits could be preserved as part of a hybrid with a southern white. But as long as they're there, then one day, hopefully, maybe in 100 years' time, we'll be able to reintroduce rhinos into that part of Africa.
It might be a long shot, but at the moment, it is the only chance to keep these rhinos from disappearing forever. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yeisu Heap in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development has awarded its flagship education project in Ghana, Partnership for Education Learning, to FHI 360, an international human development NGO. Through the project, the American people are investing $71 million to support Ghana's educational institutions over 5 years to improve, expand, and sustain learning outcomes for at least 2.8 million primary students, with an emphasis on children in kindergarten through grade 3. In partnership with the project's main implementing partner, Ghana Education Service, FHI 360 will lead a consortium composed of the Ghana Institute of Linguistics, Literacy, and Bible Translation, the Ghana Institute for Management and Public Administration, the Olinga Foundation for Human Development, and the British Council. The Learning Project is part of the USAID Partnership for Education Parent Program that is supporting early grade reading and literacy improvement activities implemented by the Ministry of Education and the Ghana Education Service. The Learning Project also includes a small component to identify approaches to improve early grade math skills. The USAID Partnership for Education Parent Program is the U.S. government's direct contribution to Ghana's 2010-2020 Education Sector Plan and its implementation, and comprises a suite of distinct but complementary projects aimed to improve child literacy and numeracy, as well as basic education systems. A sister project, Partnership for Education Testing, awarded to Research Triangle Institute in December 2012, is a four-year, $9 million project that focuses on strengthening student assessment design, administration, and dissemination, including the National Education Assessment and the newly introduced Early Grade Reading Assessment and Early Grade Math Assessment. Partnership for Education Evaluating Systems, awarded to Social Impact in September 2014, is a five-year, $12 million project supporting the Ministry of Education, Ghana Education Service, and other local partner organizations to develop a systemic, coordinated, and responsive monitoring and evaluation system that directly links to implementation of Ghana's Education Strategic Plan. The United States is proud to partner with the government of Ghana and its private sector partners in improving education for all the children of Ghana.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.